welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest is the writer Robert Eisenberg, reading from his book, The Archipelago, A Balkan Passage, published by Autumn House Press. Robert Eisenberg is a journalist, playwright, stage performer, and photographer. His book, The Archipelago, A Balkan Passage, was released by Autumn House Press in 2011. He holds an MFA from Chatham University, where he served as Whitford Fellow. He is a past winner of the Three Rivers Review Poetry Prize, and his verse has been published broadly. Originally from Vermont, he lives in Pittsburgh. Welcome to Prosody, Robert.
Thanks so much.
How about we start out tonight with you reading a little bit from The Archipelago?
All right. The bus is tiny and crowded, but this is my kind of bunch. The travelers talk to each other and stare out the window, their eyes dilated with wonder. The driver bounces us along the roads, weaving around traffic cones and construction workers. The sun is bright and the sky a cheery blue. Pop music plays mutedly through overhead speakers. The Slavic lyrics waft through the cabin. Having passed through three borders already, I'm not very concerned about the Croatian border. Of all the nations I'll visit, Croatia is by far the most American-friendly. During the war, U.S. media were favorable to Croatian forces, and peacekeepers tended to blame most atrocities on the Serbs. Croats are famous for their spotless lifestyles and fastidious natures. The Dalmatian coast has lured visitors for 2,000 years. Of all borders, this is the one most likely to wave me through. The driver collects our passports and hands them through the window, and we all wait. Once again, the ritual is unclear, but I've heard so much English aboard this bus that I assume we'll figure it out together. For the first time since Athens, I feel close camaraderie with the people around me. We are all in this together. My eyes wander outside, and I see a tall, graying border guard standing on the sidewalk. He is holding a single blue passport. He looks up straight at me. His eyes narrow. The guard raises a finger and crooks it. I point to my chest. Me? He crooks his finger again. You. I stand quickly, march down the aisle, slip out of the bus, and meet the guard on the sidewalk. Hesitation makes me suspicious. Confidence is everything. I can feel the chemistry of my brain shifting, a moment ago relaxing. Now my cerebellum has entered survival mode. I flash to my remedial psychology class. The primal brain responds to the four Fs of self-preservation, my professor explained: fight, forage, flee, and reproduction. The guard wears a gray mustache and a crisp, starched uniform. He's so tall, and I'm eye level with his taut breast pockets. He holds my passport out and breezes through the pages, then slaps the passport shut again. You have no entry stamp, he says. And like a head rush, the pieces fall violently into place. This is what Pauline was arguing about. The Montenegrin police didn't stamp my passport. They refused to stamp my passport. Government, Pauline spat. They let me through knowing that this moment would come. Even Pauline knew it would come, but he got his 50 euros, so why would he care? It's the biggest practical joke a border guard can play, except now it's very serious. I, of all people, am an actual suspect. And not for something absurd like small-time possession or shoplifting or breaking the speed limit. I'm suspected of sneaking into their country. I'm an illegal immigrant, an undocumented person. Follow me, the guard says. I follow him into the gray station house, down a corridor, then enter a small office. The office is messy with papers and swivel chairs, and a baby-faced young man sits at a computer, clicking nervously with his mouse. How did you arrive in Montenegro? The guard asks. Bus, I say reflexively. But this isn't true, you idiot. Pauline drove you. What the hell is the matter with you? I mean taxi, cab. I hired a personal driver. I shake my head, rub my cheeks, looking as dramatically flustered as I can. I'm sorry, I've been taking a lot of buses. When did you arrive? Yesterday. What time? I'm not sure, maybe noon? Where? The question takes me off guard, and I almost snort laughter. My sinuses burn with the urge to scoff. Where? Are you kidding? Some outpost in the middle of nowhere. Some dry patch of land between some Albanian village and some Montenegrin mountain. There were cows there. Does that help? I honestly don't know, I say. It was in the south. It was near Shkodër? The guard stares down at me. He turns on his heel and hands the passport to the baby-faced computer operator, who places it on a scanner. A second later, my face and information appear on the computer screen. My battered passport has never looked more fake, just a dog-eared booklet full of stamps, and how reliable is a stamp? Just ink impressions on paper. And come to think of it, what is a border, really? Just a bunch of uniformed men in a cluttered office, located somewhere between here and there. They look forward to getting overtime and vacation. They miss their girlfriends. Their border isn't even two decades old. How seriously can we take any of this? The dot matrix printer? The large windows with streaked plate glass, easily shot through by determined snipers? This is the line that divides one country from another? Am I crazy for laughing at all of this ersatz officialdom? The stern looks? The sidearm? As if I pose a significant threat? Why is nobody chuckling? I'm so sorry, I say. But it's the kind of so sorry I would say if my dog ran amok in the neighbor's lawn. The so sorry that says, man, that was stupid. Then there's the self-effacing laughter behind the words. I am performing for these men because there is no natural way to express the stupidity of this moment. This isn't my fault. I haven't lied or stolen. I stopped at the checkpoint just like every other dutiful citizen. But I have to craft my expressions carefully. I have to massage this interaction. One false move, and I'm prison candy. It will be all right, the tall officer says, and pats me on the shoulder. Then he leaves the room as two more officers enter. I expect them to shut the door and start pistol-whipping me, making absurd demands. You are a dog! Say it! You despise America! But they only sit down on the edge of their desks, arms akimbo, staring at the computer screen. You need to have an entry stamp, says the man at the computer, shaking his head and gesticulating. Otherwise, we do not know how long you are here. This rubs me the wrong way, if only because the man at the computer has the round, pale look of an office drone, and the can-do American in me knows that I could dropkick him. And where is here, I want to reply. Your country is 2 years old. It's been Serbia's conjoined twin for the past decade. Are you going to get all uppity because an American tourist wants to see your fledgling nation-state? Do I look like I want to smuggle heroin through your border? If I were that crafty, don't you think I'd skip the border altogether? Hike through the woods? Your country is dotted with war criminals, and you're worried about some clueless-looking guy wearing khaki cargo shorts? Somehow I don't feel nearly the terror I expected. I feared U.S. cops in my own neighborhood more than these men. Sure, they can do whatever they want. They can demand bribes, and there's nothing I can do but acquiesce. They can throw me in jail. How could I possibly stop them? But if they're legitimately concerned, if their only worry is my presence in Montenegro, what can they legally do? Deport me? Croatia is 30 meters away. The man at the computer examines the scan of my passport and isolates certain colors with his imaging program. Part of the passport turns pink, then the Eagle watermark lights up. I can't even imagine what he's looking for. Damaged as it is, my passport number can be verified with a single phone call. After a few minutes of watching neon colorations, the guard looks hypnotized, bored. This all seems like a show. Then the tall guard enters and my passport exchanges hands. The tall guard ushers me toward the door. Come with me, he says. We march outside back to the bus. We stand on the sidewalk. The tall guard looks away from me, toward the trees, and he pats my passport against his palm. He looks like an old Paddy playing with his baton. Then he flips the passport outward toward me, slaps it into my hand. He makes a dismissive gesture, as if to say, "Away with you!" And then he re-enters the building. I am saved by his generosity. But that's not what happens. This is what the guard wants to happen. Instead, the guard pats the passport against his palm, and then he flips it toward me. But before he can slap it into my hand, it slips from his fingers. He fumbles with it like a loose bar of soap, and for a split second his eyes panic, as if he might drop my most important document. He reflexively whispers, "Oh, sorry!" And then, just before it falls to the pavement, I catch the passport. Our fingers brush against each other. The guard recoils at his own clumsiness, his eyes narrowing, his voice harrumphing, because his tough guy moment has been spoiled by Butterfingers. He stomps off, too embarrassed to say another word, but no doubt he hears my earnest call. Thank you so much.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest is the writer Robert Eisenberg, reading from his book, The Archipelago, The Balkan Passage. So, Robert, why don't we talk about this? This is a nonfiction piece.
Yes,
this
indeed.
The I in there is not a character. It's you.
Right.
And one of the things that I found really compelling about this piece is your belief that everything would turn out okay, sometimes in circumstances where that belief might not be warranted. So let's talk about how the journey started. And, you know, particularly you took land travel the whole time. You went through Albania, which even people from the region were like, why are you going through Albania? Just a little bit about everything, about what the book's about.
Well, the premise is when I was back in high school in Vermont, I had a friend who was a refugee from Bosnia, and we were friends. We weren't terribly close, but I remembered her very well. And when we graduated, we lost touch for a number of years, and then in 2009 we reconnected on Facebook, of all things. And she sort of jokingly said, you know, now that we're back in touch, if you're interested and you're ever hanging around Sarajevo, feel free to look me up. And I had some vacation time coming up, and I thought about it, and I was like, you know, I'd love to go, but to fly directly to Sarajevo is really, really expensive. And just it's a lot of planes and so
sure.
on. So I flew directly into Athens, Greece, and then took a series of buses all through the Balkan coast, and ended up in Albania, Montenegro, Croatia, and then finally in Bosnia. And it was one of the purest things I've ever done. It was so much fun, and there were just such interesting people. And
you didn't speak the languages.
I didn't speak any of the languages. I knew a little bit. When the refugees first came in high school, I tried to learn a couple of really basic phrases, but I had been carrying around, hello, how are you, thank you for, you know.
Those will get you far.
15 years. Yeah, exactly. but that was most of what I had. I do speak German okay, and a lot of people speak German there, but mostly I was relying on people who either spoke English or were willing to have the patience to watch pantomime.
The universal language.
Exactly, exactly.
And, you know, in the book, there's another theme that runs through it, which has to do, you know, there's all these kind of situations that you go through. You have to kind of think your way through them or charm your way through them or hope that it'll work out okay. But there's also, you know, in the beginning of the book, you talk about being bullied in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of layer of violence that is underneath so much of our world, and I think in particular American culture, but around the world. And, you know, as you're traveling along, you're really going through war-torn areas that have now rebuilt themselves. And I was wondering if you could just talk about that a little, what it's like to be a tourist to a place that used to be a war zone.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the first part where, you know, I talk about my, let's say, not happy high school experience. And it was, it just happened to be that when I was in middle school and, you know, everyone is starting their sort of adolescent angst period, that was when the hostilities started breaking out in Yugoslavia. And it just happened that when I graduated in 1997, that was roughly when the ceasefire was officially in effect. And that during that period, I was literally growing up with this war, and it was sort of this bizarre expectation that as I entered adulthood, everything might fall apart in this post Cold War way. And then I went to college, and the former Yugoslavia turned into what it is now, and life just got a lot better for everybody, and. It was an interesting mirror to have. I mean, I try to say in the book that, you know, obviously I didn't survive a war,
right.
But that there's this impulse for a lot of people who are sort of just kind of damaged in their own way to really hurt the people around them. And so yeah, it was interesting to see a country that had really moved past that, a series of countries that had moved past that.
Right, and the resilience. I can't remember which city you were in the book, but I remember there's a moment where you're looking at, I think it's the tiles on the roofs, and you're with some other people talking. They're like, oh, you know, those were all gone. Those were all bombed out. Those are replicas. You know, they've reconstructed everything. And then the idea of trying to get back to some sense of normalcy after really turbulent time periods that, you know, I think probably in the last 10 years, we've thought about that a lot more than maybe we have in the last 50 years here in the
Absolutely. The greatest compliment that I've received about this, and my biggest fear was that someone from the region would read it and say, you got it completely wrong. And, you know, how would you presume to walk into a place and expect to know what's going on? And I hope I reassure the reader that I really don't, and that these are not objective observations, but actually the opposite, just very, very singular, you know.
Sure.
A singular way to digest what's happening. But a very good friend of mine from college, who is also a refugee, she ended up writing this review on Amazon for the book that was just absolutely glowing, and it apparently just really affected her well in exactly the way that I hoped.
Great.
And her comment was that there's certain things that travel writers tend to gravitate towards in any place. And her comment was her thing was the toothless old woman with the babushka wrapped around her head. She's like, every writer brings up this character. This like, you know, this is the Balkan person that you're always supposed to see in the overcast skies and the sort of Transylvanian atmosphere.
I think they have her on the postcard.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. Don't wish you were here. And she was saying it was so great to read about something that was, you know, about the war, but didn't try to dissect it or explain where it came from.
Right.
Just described sort of the beauty of the country and just this wellspring of hope that's happening right now.
Sure. And I think, you know, in particular in the U.S., a lot of times we don't have a great knowledge of the details of the rest of the world, though at times we feel we can speak about it. And so, you know, it is that you're just letting the place be the place, and not trying to impose on it any kind of history or political understanding that's beyond just being in the place at the time.
Absolutely.
Now, you're going on another trip.
Yes, indeed. So what I've found through the process of writing this and working with Autumn House and the editors there is that it was an amazingly easy project to work on and revise and draft originally because I really, really cared about it. And I realized that one of my principal interests is everyone calls it travel writing, but I don't think of it necessarily as travel writing. It's visiting places that have experienced recent national trauma. And then sort of just talking with the people there, generally reporters tend to leave after, you know, as soon as Japan recovers from
the incident, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. The tsunami and the earthquake and the meltdown and all that. The journalists are going to leave and we're just sort of going to be left with a lot of questions that eventually we'll forget. And I really don't want to forget those questions. And in this case, I'm planning to go to Laos, which is in Southeast Asia and has the unfortunate distinction of being the most heavily bombed country on Earth. And I knew nothing about it. I had no idea what its government was, what people ate there, what the religion was. And I certainly didn't know that it had experienced all of this attack. So, I'm going to head there at the end of November. And I'm going by way of Thailand. So, again, a very indirect route. And I just want to see as much as I can.
And that was something I was curious about. If you think, the question I guess I'm trying to come to is that now that you've had one of these adventures, you know, and I don't mean that in a flippant way, but, you know, there were a lot of things that went on during your first trip that are documented in the archipelago. Do you think it'll be different this time with the writing? That you'll have seen some of these things before? It seemed like everything was kind of, oh, look, now this has happened in the first book. Or not. Do you think it'll have its own kind of shape and adventure?
I have a feeling it's going to be completely different. And I'm really glad that I'm so grateful to have had so many chances to go abroad and to see a really wide variety of places and people and so on. But I think this is going to be just very, very different in a lot of ways. The language is more unfamiliar. I won't be able to read street signs and so on. But part of the draw is that Lao has this reputation for having some of the most hospitable people in the world, and that crime is very low, and that it's just a very, very traditional place. Apparently, 3/4 of the people in Lao work on farms. And it's hard to find a country that's like that anymore.
Right.
It's on paper, it's one of the poorest, and I really want to see what that means.
Sure.
But apparently, everyone I know who's been there, and there aren't a lot of people, but they always say they make people in Thailand look rude, which is really saying something.
Right.
It's such a even-minded Buddhist kind of place. I'm saying that now. I may have a different impression at the end of December.
We'll find out when you start working on the manuscript. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest is the writer Robert Eisenberg, who has read a little bit from his book, The Archipelago. Robert, how about you read some more for us?
Sounds great. Have you been to the tunnel? Amila asks. Not yet, I say. Can you tell me about it? Amila tells me about her friend Zoran. He was only a teenager, but he was the eldest brother, so he was obliged to help feed the family. Supplies were running short, and most Sarajevans were living in their cellars. Like any good entrepreneur, Zoran noticed what the Bosnians were missing. Eggs. Eggs were impossible to find, Amila recalls. I did not see an egg for God knows how long. Zoran didn't have enough money to buy eggs himself, so he asked his neighbors for loans. Going house to house, Zoran collected wads of grimy cash until he'd collected enough to buy crates full of eggs. In a sense, the neighbors were investing in Zoran's scheme, except that they expected a prompt return. So Zoran went to the tunnel. The tunnel wasn't easy to reach. Aside from snipers and artillery fire, the tunnel was located on the outskirts of town, a long, deadly walk from Sarajevo. Plus, the tunnel was tightly controlled by the new Bosnian army. There are stories of bribes and black market smuggling, though I will never know the details. I can only imagine the struggles of a plucky teenager trying to scuttle through his city's singular escape route. But he reached the tunnel's opening, and he went through. I haven't seen the tunnel yet, but Amila describes a dank mineshaft that snaked for half a mile. Because the ceiling was low, soldiers and civilians crouched along a narrow railroad track, pushing past each other in the dark. Many soldiers were wounded in combat, and they wore blood-soaked bandages. Civilians were emaciated with hunger, like living skeletons skulking through the warren. Anyone who entered was quickly streaked with grime, so each line looked like queues of zombies slinking past the tunnel's orange lamps. Zoran survived the tunnel and surfaced on the other side. He began to forage for food. Amila doesn't explain where Zoran found his crates of eggs. Was there a functional market out there in the war-torn Bosnian hills? A UN encampment? I don't know the value of Zoran's cash, or even what currency he used, or how it was printed. But Zoran found his eggs, packed into wooden crates. He bought all the eggs the money afforded, and then he tied the crates to his back. No food is more unwieldy than an egg. A cracked egg was worthless, and Zoran still had to lug his freight back through the tunnel. The first trip was terrifying, but the return trip was even harder. The tunnel's floor was flooded with mud, and as Zoran skidded along the slick surface, he feared for the safety of his eggs. All his money had gone into these eggs, all his neighbors' money, too. Without these eggs, Zoran had nothing. He could not repay his debts, he could not sustain his house or feed his family. Zoran carried entire lives on his back. And then he slipped. Zoran fell flat on his back, and as his spine slammed against the crates, he could hear 100 eggshells crunch beneath him. Though he couldn't see the eggs, Zoran probably imagined the shells cracked and shattered, the messy yolks dribbling out. Did he also imagine his family going hungry? The neighbors chasing him, beating him? Was life now over, lost in a single bad step? Zoran had no time to pity himself. His fallen body clogged the passageway. The lines of soldiers pushed up against him. The lines grew longer every second. The soldiers cried, "Get up, boy, you have to keep moving, you're holding up the line." But Zoran was lashed to his crates. The eggs were useless now, but he was tethered to his failure. He couldn't stand up or roll over. His feet scraped uselessly at the ground. He was dead weight, a clot in the tunnel's artery. How many hundreds of soldiers would arrive late at the other end of the tunnel because Zoran had stood in their way? And not even stood, but sprawled. So Zoran looked at the cold black ceiling, and he spread his arms out, and he cried, "I'm done. Let me die. Just let me die." But as Emila tells me about Zoran, she is laughing, hysterically. She throws her head back, giggling to the sky. She says again, imitating Zoran, "Let me die," and her laughter is renewed, louder than before. I try to mimic her laugh, but I don't know why. What about this denouement could possibly be funny? "I'm sorry, Emila," I say, still forcing out uncomfortable chuckles, "but this seems like a tragic story." Emila waves this off, then sips her coffee and calms herself. "It is much funnier the way he tells it," Emila says, as she takes a cleansing breath. "You have to hear him tell the story. When he says, 'Just let me die,' it is much funnier in Bosnian."
It must be, because it's heartbreaking in English.
So for what it's worth, I don't remember if I say it in the book, but he actually apparently managed to keep a lot of the eggs and sold them and paid back the money. So,
well, that's good. I was worried for it.
It worked out. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Not to ruin that. It's in a small bit. But So
I also know that you have a new book of poetry out, and we're almost done with our time together, but I did want to ask you if you would at least read one of your poems for us.
That sounds great. The book is called Wander.
Great.
And I lucked out, and Six Gallery Press decided to put it out. I'm not known much as a poet, but I'm hoping that that reputation will change.
Great.
The boy totes a card tray slung around his duck neck. And when he blocks my diagonal step, I'm forced to catalog his wares. Square lighters, rust-pecked metals, brass bullet casings, watches stripped from the meat of butchered GIs. The boy is 30 years too young to really know what he is vending, or to whom, though both of us were born to buy and sell this tray of father's scars. "No, thank you," I say. But his milky eyes meet my blues. He chirps, "Why?" All night I drag his why, along the sooted sidewalk, past the bloated rat that shimmies into gutter, to a club called Apocalypse Now, where fragile boys sell books from stacks that entwine their torsos. I sip why from tumblers. The speakers blare why. A membrane of why sticks to my sandals. All eyes, forever after, everywhere, glint why.
Thanks for coming to Prosody, Robert.
Absolutely. Thank you, Ellen.
You've been listening to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday at 6:30 for Prosody, an independent public radio, 90.5 FM.